Okay, it is now my honor.
Drum roll.
To introduce our speaker, Greg G., with 23 years from Porterville.
Forty-five minutes. Somebody will have to tell me when it's time for me to shut up. So I brought my cheater. So, Billy, can you see me?
It's kind of
My name is Greg. I am an alcoholic. I admitted that on January 15th, 1999, on my way to a treatment center. And 30 days later, I get to come and join you in all these rooms. And here I am. What a great gathering. I haven't been here in a couple of years. This is fabulous. I have never seen that many baskets in any meeting, party or otherwise, ever. That's great. Fabulous. I want to thank Christy and the committee for inviting me to come and share my story. And I think we'll begin with inviting my higher power into the conversation so that we'll be honest. So as a young guy growing up, I lived in a family that was alcoholically infused, dysfunctional, and I didn't know that. I probably didn't recognize it until I became of the age, you know, where you could do a sleepover with somebody else. And I'd go to a friend's house, and there wasn't the same kind of atmosphere or mood or chaos that that I experienced in my own home. I got to high school age, and there was this insane thinking that would go on inside my head. And like many of you, I found a little help, and alcohol became my therapy. I didn't know that it was going to become my crutch, but that's how my life began. And I began to quiet down the noise in my head. Today, I'd probably take Ritalin or something, but that's what we had in the 70s. You know, I was 43 years old when I got here, and I had told this young gal that I had married right out of high school that I never wanted to be like my father, and yet I turned out to be, in her words, my father. And I came to the conclusion that alcohol had finally kicked my ass. Along the way, I had been exposed to four interventions. And my friend who was performing these interventions got better and better at his craft. And by the time the last one came around, I said, yeah, okay, I think you're right, but I don't know what to do. And he says, well, we do. And the next day, I'm on the bus to a recovery center up in the Gold Country. When I was getting ready to leave that center, they told me that they felt like I was in need of three 12-step programs. One of them is this, Alcoholics Anonymous. One was Narcotics Anonymous, and the other was some kind of codependency program, which they told me about CODA. And I went to a couple of those meetings. Those are scary people. I ended up aligning more with the Al-Anon people. It was during that period of time in that treatment center that I recognized what goes on in the family dynamic of an alcoholic home. You know, you got caregivers and you've got power drivers and lots of insanity. And as I began to recognize the various characters that were in my own family and the characters that were developing in my young family, it sort of fueled the need to make changes in my life. So I left that treatment center admitting that I was an alcoholic. I had an experience there that has gotten between me and the thought of drink. I've never had a chemical relapse, and that's not going to be my story today. I'm going to talk to you about the other type of relapse, and that's the emotional relapse. And I continue to struggle with emotional relapses. This great spirit of mine seems to keep me out of the trouble of returning to drink, but he reminds me sometimes that how I got here was when I reached these points of desperation, and these desperations are usually when I ask him to end my life. Take it away. Get me out of this pain. Give me a heart attack. I'm too much of a coward to eat a bullet. At about when I was in this treatment center, they had a family day, you know, where your loved ones show up and tell you what it's been like to live with you. And mine shows up with a goodbye letter, a restraining order, and tells the staff, you got him, you keep him, he's no longer welcome in Porterville. They kind of rallied around her and asked her to kind of give me a chance because they were seeing a difference in me. And when she did allow me to come home, a year later I'd given up nicotine and I had my first major emotional relapse. And the next day my sponsor's at my house and she's asking me to pack my bags and away I go and live somewhere else for a year. I didn't like that. You know, I was doing everything that the people in the program suggested to me, get a sponsor, go to meetings, work steps. In that first year, I had done 500, Billy? There are some younger guys, but he's got 10 years, guys that would come into the program, and I would tell them I'd done 500 meetings in my first year, and they'd say, oh, bullshit, until they did 500 meetings, and then they recognized that it is a commitment. And the commitment served me well enough that I did not drink or consider drinking, but it did not do enough to let go of my will upon the way my life should be lived. And so I get booted. I go and live in a motel for a week or two. It's obvious it's not going to change. I clear out my office and turn it into an apartment, and I'm living in this steel building. And I'm resentful. I'm ticked off. I'd go to the Porterville men's meeting. I'd puke out all of my discontent. And if any of you guys are here, Art, I appreciate you listening to me during that period of time, but I just had to get rid of it. And one night I'm coming home, and this is the first of my intuitive thoughts, and to get into my little office, it's a steel building, shop building, enclosed in a chain link fence, and I have to shine my headlights on the tumbler of the padlock so that I can open that gate so I can get inside, chain it from the inside, walk up and unlock my door. And while I'm fumbling with the tumbler on this lock, a thought comes into my head. Maybe this is a marvelous opportunity to work on you. What? Yeah, time for you to work on you. There's nobody else around. You're not trying to work your program on your family. You can work this program on you. Huh. I get inside and I recognize that when I was in treatment, I was in daily prayer, daily meditation. But now that I wasn't in treatment, I wasn't in prayer and meditation any longer. I was returning slowly to my old ways. So that night I was on my knees praying for the restoration of my family. And that became an evening and morning ritual for a long period of time. It didn't get better. It got worse. The first 2 years of my recovery were worse than the last 2 years of my drinking. Because I was sober, I was not under the influence, and I could feel everything, but my life wasn't being ordered because I was in the way of my God. My God was trying to right my wrongs, but I was interfering. Third step talks about releasing my will to Him. my life and my will. My life and my will. My will is my thinking, my life are my actions, and I was still trying to control all that. And as I returned to the recognition that I needed to ask for guidance, just as I asked for guidance in what I share with you today, then I was able to get back and link and sync with the God of my understanding. And in time, He gave me some opportunity. The first opportunity was when I felt like things weren't happening the way they should be. I'm getting close to the end of this year of living alone. And I consult somebody in the program who is an attorney. And I said, you know, I may need some guidance here in terms of the divorce. And so we talked a little bit about, you know, what scale of an attorney and that type of thing I might need. And he, the attorney friend, mentioned to me, you know, you might want to go meet with your wife and have a discussion. Talk about this before we go any further. So I called her up and I asked if I could come over to the house and to talk to her. Now, I'd always been the kind of guy that sat at the head of the table, not at the side of the table, and sort of directed the conversation. And this time I came over, I sat at the side of the table, and she sat at the side of the table, and I spoke from my heart and not from this alcohol-damaged organ between my ears. And I told her how I felt about her, and I told her about how I wanted to see if we could find a way to reconcile. Now, we had done years of marriage counseling over the years, you know, probably 4 years with one stint. And so we were no neophytes to the world of professional care. She agreed that it was probably worthy of a try, but you were not moving back in. And I said, okay. So we found counsel, someone who was familiar with 12 steps, familiar with what we go through, how we resurrect our lives. She was involved in Al-Anon, and we gave it another try. And some number of months later, we were able to live together. I'd like to say happily, but it's a progress, you know. It's a slow thing. The point I want to make of all that is it brought me to a greater understanding of what I really want to talk about, and that's the use of the steps. The fact that we're born into this life without an owner's manual. I didn't come here with a how-to. I came here with what didn't work. And I kept trying to make the didn't work work, and now I want to live a life what works works. In other words, live in the solution to my problem, not in the problem. And so we go on a mission of living life on a new footing, where God is our director, living more of the third step and less of the chaos of our own free will. A few years ago, this lady got sick and died. And it's still tough, you know. I was talking to some people today about how you walk through grief, and I don't know any right or wrong way. You just show up and do the best you can with it. I will tell you that having a program and being active in a program sustained me through all of that, and I recovered, I believe, reasonably well. A couple of years after that, my mother passed, and I was able to walk through that too. What I've learned along the way in these steps is that I'm powerless over almost everything. I was born into this world as a person who is obsessive and compulsive, and I don't have an off switch. I tend to do everything to excess. And it doesn't necessarily have to be destructive. I can work to excess. I can sleep to excess. I can stay awake to excess. You know, it's just that's the nature of my wiring. The solution to that is to try and seek some balance. And as I work through continually looking at the unmanageability of my life, it gives me the opportunity to sort of correct. What I didn't understand was this thing about insanity. Because I grew up in a world where I thought the environment that I lived in was normal until I'm exposed to other ways of living. And today, I recognize that it's abnormal. Insanity is doing, as you know, the same thing over and again, expecting a different result. I think sanity is about finding peace at the end of that trail. And we live in an insane world where every day we're bombarded with insane thinking, problematic thinking, and a lack of God. The God of your understanding is the one that you need a relationship with, just as the God of the understanding that I have is the one that I need a relationship with. It was through prayer and meditation that I was able to sort of develop that relationship. And each time, what stimulated that was the crisis that might be in my life at the moment. These emotional relapses that I experience are opportunities for me to return to that basic understanding of what my life should, the day should start with and end with. Starting with some spiritual reading. Starting with some moment with the God of my understanding, some meditation. And allowing Him to sort of direct my life. And when I do that, I have better days than when I don't do that. And so I know that that's the key. And ending my day, you know, with that 10-step type of thing where I take some stock in how my day went. And I've never really gotten to being a formalized journaling. I've never really done that. But I do take stock in how my day went. The difficulty is being consistent for me. I haven't perfected any type of consistency in working that type of spiritual program on a day by day, week by week basis. When I'm in crisis, it's automatic. I do that. But when things start getting good, when things start going well, I sort of step aside from that. And so that really is the continuing character defect that maybe I'll work on that for a long time. I don't know. I'm looking forward to the day when I'm in great peace. The third step was the most difficult one, followed by the seventh step that I've had to wrestle with. This idea of offloading my will in my life to a power that I can't grasp. I can experience, but I can't grasp. If I try to get my arms around it, get my thought around it, it disappears. Left me wanting. And I felt like I would be some kind of automaton, you know, a robot. And it's not that. I had to finally just say, okay, fine, here I am. And I can remember the day that it happened. I was doing my spiritual reading in the morning, and I would go into my office and write down whatever my lesson was for the day, and I would stick that on the dash of my car. I'm a farmer, you know, my in those days my car was my office, and I would stick it on the dash, and I would work that lesson as I went through my day. And it was greatly about inviting this power greater than me into my life and being active. And I was always resistive to that. It was sort of like, then who the hell am I, you know? And so I can remember one day I just said, okay, fine. There it is. I'm yours. We'll go here. I'll do what you say. I'll be as you suggest. And it was like I walked into a new room. It was a room filled with light. And it became very easy that day for me to get through that day. And so I remember that frequently, when I become discouraged, that the answer is always there. I just need to ask. But then when things get good, you know, I start wanting to take the steering wheel back. So here we are. My first sponsor and I worked on the inventory for quite a few months. And it wasn't him working on it, it was my reluctance to work on it. And it was the wrong approach for me. I know that I needed to offload all of this mistakes and errors that I had made, you may call them sins, that I had done over the years. But really what I come to recognize was that when I shared it in a fifth step, I got no relief from that. And when I moved to my second sponsor, he explained to me that what the fourth step is about is taking a look at what are my values. And whenever I'm disturbed, no matter the cause, there's some value in here that's in question. That's what's getting me anxious. That's what's pissing me off. That's what's creating my road rage. That's where my anger comes from. And when I'm able to find the willingness to take a look at what that value is, and I may have to delve down three or four dermal layers to get to what the heck's going on, then I'm able to come to terms with the fact that my value may be the problem. And when I'm able to find that value, that core value, then I'm able to take it to my maker and work it through a ninth step and be done with it. It took me a few years to find that degree of willingness, that honesty, that faith. It stated that I made a fearless moral inventory. And so it's the fear that I'm going to release to somebody something that I did. The fearlessness is to take a look at what is my value in this. And as I've sort of learned how to do that, it's become easier for me to let go of some of my old ideas. And it's my old ideas that keep me locked up. It's my old ideas that are fueling these emotional relapses. It's these old ideas that gets between me and you. And I want to have a relationship between me and you. I want to be honest with me and you. I want to be loving and caring with me and you. I do not want to do any damage to anyone or anything in my world today. But these old ideas interfere sometimes. And so this process that's opened up in the fourth step gets me going in the direction of figuring out what that value is. And then I get the opportunity to share it with my God, myself, and you. And the beauty of that is I can't be dishonest with all three of these parties at the same time. And so I get very honest with me about that. Now here comes the kicker. Once I've defined what it is that is disturbing me, then I need to become absolutely ready to let go of that defect of character. And when I'm in pain, there is no question. I'm ready to give it up. But the minute I'm not in pain, I might need that someday. I might need it next day. I don't know if I want to give up that activity. I might want to continue to have that fantasy. You know, whatever it is that I'm trying to let go of. And so my will returns. I've pulled that damn thing back into my camp, and here we go. And so in order to get to an effective seventh step, I've got to do something about that sixth step. And so as I said before, it's a stumbling block for me. And once I finally come to terms with the fact that I'm not going to be able to rest any type of peace in this realm without letting go of it absolutely, as it's outlined in the step, then I finally become willing to let go of it. Now, as my sponsor told me, here's the magic. Actually, the miracle. The miracle is when I get to that seventh step, my job is to give that defect of character to my God. And it's no longer mine. I don't own it. It doesn't belong to me anymore. And in fact, I'm probably a thief if I take it back. And so I've mostly been successful at giving it to my maker and walking away. And when it comes up, I throw up my hands and say, it's not my business. And that's helped me in a lot of areas of life today. It's not my business anymore. It's not my business what goes on with other people. It's not my business what people think of me. It's my business to what I think of you and what I think of me. And I need to stay in my lane in order so that I can stay clean with my maker. So how has this served me? Well, there's less frequency of emotional relapse. There's less problems with road rage. There's less problems with my life. And there is more faith in that I have a solution to my problems. And so that's where I tend to go. The next little kicker along the way was this making amends, man. And I still struggle with this one. I remember that the first amends that I made, there were twofold. One was to my first sponsor, who I had fired. I sent him a dozen roses and a goodbye letter. And a week or so later, we had lunch, and I told him, I just needed to move on. The next day, PRASA was in Reno. My mother was living up there after my dad died with her, her side of the family. And I did not go to the banquet. And I invited my mother to dinner, and I made my amends with her. The interesting thing was I had three younger sisters. My dad was not a nice guy. He was an abuser, and as I got older, I just liked that. I threatened to kill him when I was about 13. He became a psychological abuser after that, and I held my mother accountable. You see, that's the error of my way is I held her accountable for what was going on. And when I did my inventory, I recognized she wasn't wrong. She was doing the best she could to survive it. I didn't have much of a relationship with my dad before he died. I couldn't remember good times with him. I could remember the ugliness, the darkness of the whole thing. I met her for dinner. I made my amends. I told her what I just told you, that I was wrong to have held her in contempt, held her accountable. I recognize today that she did the best she could to survive it, and I appreciated her being there for my sisters. The interesting thing was, I wasn't making an amends to my dad. I had recognized in doing the inventory with her that he had a dark spirit, and he was plagued. He was an alcoholic that was without hope. What happened was the transformation, the miracle of transformation that comes from that ninth step with myself. And what happened for me is I no longer remembered those bad times. I began to remember good times. I began to see him in a different light. And I was freed of that connection to his darkness. It evaporated. It evaporated in the moment that I shared this amends with my mother. My relationship with my mother took a while to regenerate. She began in a few years to come and spend the winters in Porterville with me for a few months and stay at my house. And she and I rekindled a life. I honored her. I began to quit calling her by her first name and calling her mom. I began to recognize that she was a lovely person. And we enjoyed a beautiful experience as a father and as a son and a mother for the next few years before she left this earth. I think that that would not have been possible if I had not found the willingness to do the inventory and had not found the miracle of making the amends. Here's another one that I like to use when I'm talking to people about this inventory and the amends process. So I'm a farm guy that when I got to recovery, I was dead broke, probably should have been bankrupt, but I was too stupid to look at it. Hadn't filed my taxes in a few years, had lots of debt, and I had a lot of old beat-up equipment. And my wife shows up in my yard one day with a clipboard, and she asked me if I've got a few minutes, and I said, yeah, of course. So we go outside, and we're walking around this equipment yard, and she's making notes in our on a clipboard, tell me about this tractor and about that truck. And I said, well, you know, the tags that are on that truck really belong on that truck, and the plate on that truck belongs on that truck, and I've got title to this one, and that one belonged to some corporation that went defunct years ago, and you know, and she gets all done, and she says, you got a pile of shit.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, but it's my shit. And I might need this stuff someday. And she looks at me and she says, are you a mechanic? And I said, no, but my brother-in-law is. And she says, oh, those shade tree guys that you and your sons bitch about all the time because it takes them 2 days to fix something so you can use it for 2 hours. And I said, yep, that's the guys. And she says, you got to get rid of this. I don't want to listen to you guys complain about equipment anymore. It's time that you start re-equipping. And I think she was really looking out for her youngest son, figuring that I'd buy this new stuff and get it paid for before he took over, you know. So she calls up some salvage guy, and he comes and unloads my yard. And the next day I walk out of my office, and it's like, there's nothing out there. I felt naked. And it was time to start making amends. The first amends was to the local tractor dealer, who I'd stiffed on some deal, you know, many years ago. He'd gotten paid through collections, but he didn't get the full ride. So I go down to visit with him and, you know, was honest, told him about where I'm at and what I'm trying to do and what I need to do. The owner of the tractor company had died since then. The guy that's there knew me, didn't know the whole story. He says, let me work on it. And he goes upstairs, and they go through all their records. He calls me up the next day. Greg, we can't find anything. You're clean. What do you want? I said, I want to buy a new tractor. No problem. Come fill out the application. I fill it out, and I get the new tractor. That's 18 years ago, and I don't know, $750,000 later, and we're still buying equipment. And it never would have happened if I hadn't have been honest, if I hadn't made amends, if I hadn't have been willing to make it right. And in this process of making it right, I've learned that if I'm lacking something in my life, I need to make the amends for what I'm lacking. I need to seek out who it is that I harmed. Where is it that I have caused an injury, and fix it. And it takes tremendous willingness to do that. The embarrassment, the humiliation is trumped by the humility. And as I experience the humility, I become willing to do more of it. And it seems to work in every area of my life, except the one that you would really like to see happen. And those are in those close personal relationships, especially with family. And the most difficult one I've had is with my two sons. Susan asked me one time, she came into my life after Linda passed, "Tell me about your amends with your sons." And we're sitting in a public place, and I start crying, you know, and I recognize that I hadn't made amends to them. And I was due to, this is after Linda passed, and I was due to fly up to northern Idaho to visit with a friend of mine. And I just instinctually knew it was time that I finished that business. And I got 10 minutes, so I better hurry up. So I go to get on the airplane, and I know that there's a problem with this. And that is I had unfinished business with her mom. You know, I was still holding on to a grievance with her. And so I get up to my friends, and you know, and he was at one point my sponsee, and then we become sort of sponsors to each other. And frankly, in my world, sponsee is not a hierarchy. It's just me and them having a channel, and really it's a power greater than us that is the conversation. It's not filtered through me, but comes out of me. And so we worked through this little process, and I came back with my amends for my wife written out. Now, what spawned all of this was a grievance I was having with my oldest daughter-in-law. And the next week after I returned home would have been our 41st wedding anniversary. And she sends me a text. "I know it's a tough day for you. I love you." Shit. How can your spirit throw rocks at that? You know, you just have to say, okay, I'm on your page. And I turned the phone off, and I said, "Today's the day." And I pulled out the amends, and I had a little prayer with my deceased wife. And I forgave her, and I begged for her forgiveness, and I spent the day weeping. And for me, weeping is cleansing. You know, it allows me to enjoy with the Spirit. And if Matt's still here, you know, he sent me a text today, and I said, "Look, I look forward to being here with you, and our two spirits will mingle together, and the great Spirit will speak through us." And that's what happened that day. And then after that, I tried to make amends with my sons, and they didn't want to hear any of that. See, they're still wrestling with the pain of their youth, of living with an active alcoholic, and the chaos that I walked through. And they don't have this program as a tool, as a mechanism for overcoming those resentful periods. So with them, I've had to learn how to be an example, how to be of service to them. As if one of them's walked through a divorce that was not good. I used to send my housekeeper up to his house to make sure that they were eating well and living as human beings. My son was raising his young son when his wife left. The other one's going through, his wife's going through cancer treatments, and, you know, I'm there. This coming week, I'm the driver to chemo, you know, and I'm okay with all that. The point I'm trying to make is that I have to live some of these amends. I can't just give them. And amends is not saying I'm sorry. Amends is demonstrating to me, to you, and to the God of my understanding, that my behavior has been modified by what I started in that fourth step. That I've let go of that old behavior. I've let go of that value that I held so dear, and I've embraced some new value. And the value might be that I just love you. The value could be what is really wrapped up in the Lord's Prayer when it says, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. In other words, I can't be forgiven if I don't forgive. And so even though they hold on to a resentment towards me, I need to recognize that they have that right of indignation. They have the right to be indignant about the way they felt that they were treated. And I have the responsibility to love them as if that never happened. And before I start bawling like a five-year-old, I'm going to say I appreciate the opportunity to be here and be with you and share my story. It's always evolving. I am grateful to have spent the last 23 and some number of months as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am grateful to have a power greater than me as an active part of my life today. And I am grateful to be here with you today. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Greg. Okay. What a great message.
Still works.